All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Our guest this hour is Albert V. Krebs. He directs the Corporate Agribusiness Research Project, is the author of the book The Corporate Reapers, the Book of Agribusiness, and he publishes the AgBiz Teller online and the Agribusiness Examiner newsletter. He has worked with the National Sharecroppers Fund, the Agribusiness Accountability Project with Jim Hightower, Consumer Action San Francisco, Rural America, Ralph Nader's Center for the Study of Responsive Law, and Prairie Fire Rural Action. Mr. Krebs is also on the board of directors of the North American Farm Alliance and Family Farm Defenders. He is a member of the Organic Consumers Association Policy Advisory Board and the International Forum on Food and Agriculture. He writes for the Progressive Populist and won the National Farmers Union's Milt Haeckel Award for journalism covering farm and ranch issues. And Mr. Krebs also served as committee coordinator on the Family Farmers National Alliance for the Nader-LaDuke presidential campaign in the year 2000. Wow. If I had to keep reading this resume, I don't know if I'd have time to ask you any questions.
That's right.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, you can call me Al, by the way.
Okay. Welcome to the show, Al.
Glad to be with you.
Great. So I was reading Counterpunch, and I read an article that you wrote about the farm subsidies, where you said they're really not farm subsidies at all. They're subsidies for Archer Daniels Midland and the giant agribusiness corporations.
That's right.
Can you explain what you mean by that, please?
Well, the public perception is that the money that that's being paid out in these subsidies is going to the farmer, and the farmer is simply getting rich off these subsidies, when in fact that most of the subsidies that the farmer gets today barely meets his cost or her cost of production. So, in other words, they're producing below the cost of production. They're selling their grain to the big grain traders, and then the grain traders trade that grain. As I often say, you know, grain farmers don't trade grain. Grain traders trade grain. And consequently, the money is really going into the pockets of the big grain companies, because they're getting the crop at the below cost of production. You know, it's like the old story of the farmer when they ask him how is his cash flow, and he said the flow is fine. I just like to stop some of the time. You know, and that's the problem. The farmer is paying more for their input costs and everything, and that keeps going up while the price that they get for their product decreases all the time. So the subsidy is really not going to the grain farmer. In effect, it's going to the big traders.
And I believe you wrote that Archer Daniels Midland is the biggest welfare recipient in America. Is that right?
Well, in terms of the different subsidies that it gets and its political power in Washington, you could well say that, yes, that they are one of the largest recipients, and they certainly throw their political power around Washington.
All the Sunday morning news shows have nothing but ADM commercials all the way.
That's right. And they keep promoting this image that they're feeding the world and so forth. And actually, what they're doing is they're taking a very cheap product they get, and they're selling it around the world to undercut the pricing of the crops that the people in those countries grow and produce.
Okay, well, I grew up in the suburbs, and I truthfully don't know a thing about ranching or farming or anything else, so I wonder if maybe we can go back in history a little bit and understand the evolution of the family farm into the ADMs of today, and how the government began subsidizing farms, and what was the purpose of it, and how did it get corrupted, or did it, and that kind of thing.
Well, we could probably, without going back throughout the entire history of the country, we could go back to the the 1920s and 30s when we were having reoccurrent farm depressions, you know, and the Roosevelt administration came in, and a new agricultural policy at that time was adopted whereby there would be price supports. In other words, be determined a certain price for a product by in terms of the input costs and so forth. And then if the market didn't support that price, why the government would support it through these price supports. Well, through various conservative elements within the farm community and principally the American Farm Bureau Federation, they've been fighting over the last three quarters of a century to eliminate those price supports because they claimed it was, quote, government interference in the free market. And so they in turn, though, turned around and replaced those, support prices with the subsidy, different subsidies for different aspects, conservation for crop and so forth, and even to the extent of where they paid subsidies to some of these large corporations to promote their products abroad. Then in 1972, when we had the famous Russian wheat sale, one of the great American grain robberies, we often referred to it.
Hey, well, the Red Army had to eat somehow.
Huh?
The Red Army had to eat somehow.
Well, no, it wasn't. It was a case of the grain companies knew that this deal with the Russians was afoot, and so they were coming along and buying the grain very cheaply. In other words, the farmers were the last ones to know about the fact that Russia desperately needed wheat, and the grain companies knew this, and they came along, and not only were they buying the grain cheaply, but they were getting subsidies from the government to promote the wheat and the wheat sales to the Russians. And at that time, it was determined by the Nixon administration and people like Henry Kissinger and so forth that the United States should have what was called the comparative advantage, or any country should have a comparative advantage, which was their argument, meaning that if a country was outstanding in certain aspects of food production, in other words, certain crops, then they should be granted the liberalization of the tariffs and the prices and so forth. Well, of course, the United States, being the so-called breadbasket to the world, that gave the United States an enormous advantage over the rest of the countries in the world. Meanwhile, however, though, the Europeans were still paying subsidies to their farmers because they believed in the value not only in keeping the prices low to the consumer and so forth, but they also believed in the fact that there was a certain culture that was to be maintained, in other words, to maintain the culture in agriculture, so to speak. And because a lot of the families and people living in Europe still had ties to their land and still had ties to farms, despite the fact that they might be living in some of the cities, why the Europeans were paying these high subsidies. Well, this was a constant source of annoyance to the U.S. Agriculture policymakers, and so they embarked at that time on a program to try to get the Europeans to cut their subsidies, and they did this through this so-called comparative advantage business, you know, that in other words, that we should be the ones that should have the the breaks in terms of trading the various grains that we produce and lead the world. And at the same time, they were selling the fact to the farmer that if they wanted to maintain their economic viability, they needed to get big or get out. And plants fence row to fence row with the crops. Well, a lot of the farmers did that in the 70s. They bought up what land they could. They planted fence row to fence row, but the export market never really materialized the way it did, and consequently they came into the 80s and they found themselves in serious debt. And that's when you had so many family farms going out of business and bankruptcies and penny sales in the farms and all the newsreel shots of the typical farmers going out of business and so forth. In the meantime, however, as I said, the export market was not that great, and rather than increase our market share of the world, we saw it decreasing, and of course that occasioned Congress to adopt a farm policy that included paying off these subsidies to these farmers. And as we've said earlier, most of those subsidies, of course, were nothing but cash cows for the grain companies. So, in a sense, what happened then with the 1996 Farm Bill, which was called the misnomer Freedom to Farm, was that they finally did away with the price supports after all those years, in terms of a seven-year phase-out of the entire program, which has not really taken place because of the weak market abroad. In the meantime, however, you've had the less developed countries and everything really making stink about this, because what a lot of these big companies have done is they've come into the country, they've taken out the raw materials from that for food, and processed and valued, so-called value added to them, and then turned around and sold them back to the country as a manufactured food product at a price that these countries cannot afford. And that's basically what the whole ruckus at Cancun was about, in terms of the third world saying we want to have control over our own destiny in terms of our food production, because next to life itself, food is the greatest common denominator.
Okay, so if I understand you right, let me make sure before I get too far behind here, I want to make sure I understand. It started out with modest price supports during the Great Depression and that kind of thing, and then in the name of stopping the government from interfering in the free market, the big agribusiness companies pushed the price supports with subsidies that end up going toward them instead of toward the farmer. And then, let's see, I think in the way you describe what they did in the 70s and 80s, convincing the farmers to go into debt, to expand fence row and all that, is really the same thing that you're saying the government is doing to these third world countries too. This supposedly free market that they don't like government interference, they're using the government to tell these people that they have to go into debt to expand all their production, but then when the sale never comes and they go bankrupt, they get to come in and, in the case of the Americans, buy up the family farm when they go bankrupt, or in the case of the third world countries, like you're saying, take all their food and then sell it back to them at a marked up price. Is that correct?
Well, That's correct, but the one other aspect to that is the fact that in the case of the third world countries, the countries have been for too long been told to, in other words, to meet their balance of payments, they have to produce what's called cash crops, in other words, crops that they can export. And of course, that's taking the land away from crops to raise for the to self-sustaining for their own people. Okay? So, in a sense, the corporate agribusiness has been racing, as they say, race to the bottom. Like even now, we see it in the industrial sector. You know, looking around the world for the cheapest raw materials that they can possibly find along with, quote, cheap labor, meaning family farms, and producing those cash crops of which they can turn around and like what we're seeing in Mexico, that the Mexican farmers, for example, are with their corn production, you know, are being wiped out because all this corn that's being produced in the United States is being dumped into Mexico at a price that the Mexican farmer cannot compete with.
And if I understand right, the reason that the trade talks, the WTO talks, broke down in Cancun last week was because the U.S. still has barriers so that where we're dumping corn into Mexico's market, for example, they can't sell their corn here. Or the African countries are barred from selling their cotton here because we already have perhaps overproduction of cotton here. The last thing we need is a bunch of even cheaper African cotton. So we have all this protectionism while we demand free trade from them.
That's what it basically amounts to, yes.
And that's why they walked out of the meeting.
And that's why they walked out of the meeting. That's right. Yeah. And I do not see very much light at the end of the tunnel on the issue, because as long as the Europeans and the U.S. Are united in this thing about wanting to this open market, so to speak, we're going to be stuck with this question on the subsidies. Now, there's a way out domestically in the U.S. A lot of us have been arguing for 20, 30, 40 years, and that is that you, one, put a cap on the subsidies, and two, you when you start distributing the subsidies, you distribute them from the bottom up instead of from the top down. But Congress is reluctant to do that because it goes back again to the whole question of campaign financing. Where do they get their money for their campaigns? They get them from these big corporations, you know, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, you know. I mean,
and see, back in the day, there were enough farmers to vote that the farm vote mattered. I think I remember it made news that, was it the State of the Union speech of 1996 was the first State of the Union speech in history where the president didn't even mention the word farmers one time.
That's right. That's right. There's only 1.9 million farmers in this country, according to the latest USDA census, you know. And a very small percentage of those are actually what you could call commercial farmers. In other words, that they sell to the commercial market. And, of course, they're getting larger and larger. The smaller farms, the threat to the family farms today is not so much what we call corporate farms, but the threat is development. In other words, farmers realizing that the only way they're going to maintain their existence is to sell their farm and get what money they can for it. And of course, the people that come along that can offer them the best price on that are the developers.
Okay, now, I want to understand the difference between, you know, a guy who's just a lousy farmer and doesn't make his money and loses his farm, and the deliberate program where Archer Daniels Midland can really use the power of the state to get people's farms from them.
Right. Well, now, Archer Daniels Midland themselves do not own any farms. You know, it's control is the issue here. It's and they control those farms by the price they pay. Second of all, the farmers that you refer to as inefficient and so forth, they're long gone. You know, most of your farmers are going out of business now. Are by most standards very efficient. They just don't have a price. That's the big issue, to get a fair price for what they produce. And once that happens, then farmers will find it profitable to stay small, and they won't be looking for the ways to get out of it. Right now, the two most popular ways that the government tells farmers is to either borrow or to sell their land. Well, that's no solution, because to sell their land means they get out of farming, and to borrow means they get deeper and deeper into debt, because as long as you keep paying a high price for your inputs and you're not getting a fair price for your outputs, there's no way you can ever pay off that debt.
So that's the cause then of like the rash of, I remember reading about all the people who were forced to sell their family farm in the late 80s and mm-hmm. in the 90s. I think you described before how they were encouraged to go into debt to do all this expansion to raise more product that they ended up never being able to sell. And so I guess what I'm trying to understand is like the bigger reasons for why there was this giant rash of all these people forced to sell their farms. And who did they sell them to? What happened to this farmland? Who owns it now?
Well, a lot of them sold them to the developers, and the other ones, a lot of them were bought up by their neighbors and everything. I mean, when we're talking about the farmer is probably the only segment of our economy that sells wholesale and buys retail. And when you've got that situation, you've got a no-win situation. And so
I don't understand. How is it that they buy retail and sell wholesale?
They buy their inputs on retail prices, and then they sell.
So you mean the machinery and the seeds and all that? They just have to buy. You're saying they buy all that retail.
That's right. And who controls those products? The highly concentrated corporate agribusiness sector, seeds and energy and chemicals and fertilizer, etc. They all have to buy those at retail prices. Whereas the price that they sell is they have no control over. They have to. In other words, they basically have to sell at a wholesale price that is determined in some measure by the same corporations that they bought from.
So really, what's different in this from just sharecropping back after the days of the Civil War? Just that it's high-tech and bigger?
That's right. Basically, the farmers today have become, family farmers today have become sharecroppers, farm workers, whatever you want to call them, but that's basically what they've become. They have little or no control over the price that they receive for what they produce. And very interestingly enough, when the government was telling farmers back in the 70s to get bigger, get out, and they didn't do that. Farmers that didn't do that, they were the ones that survived in the 80s. But the problem is now that the situation has gotten so bad that even those farmers can't make it. And they're the ones that are going out of business. To say nothing of the fact that because the whole farm economy is the whole rural economy in our country has been rooted for so long on the farm sector, is that it's becoming systemic, and we're seeing the disappearance of our rural communities because there's no economy there. Because if a family farm is able to operate the way it should, then it has what they call a price multiplier of 5 to 7. In other words, the money that the farmer brings over changes 5 to 7 times beyond the farmer. He buys stuff from the local stores and so forth and so on. And but with the large corporations coming in there, the Cargills and the ADMs buying it, and that money doesn't stay in the community. It goes goes to Decatur, Illinois, or up to Minneapolis. There's no way that the rural community can sustain itself.
So, who's going to grow all our food? If they're all run out of business, are we just going to have? We're going to become an importer nation then, or what?
No. We're going to have in the neighborhood of maybe of a couple hundred thousand farmers producing most of our food, and then importing the rest of. We're already importing. A lot is often made about how the U.S., as I said earlier, was the world's breadbasket, and how we'll be the world's largest exporter of food and everything. But we're also the second largest importer of food in the world. And we're seeing that in what USDA calls complementary and supplementary imports. Supplementary imports being the products that we don't grow, like coffee and cocoa and things like that. Whereas the complementary products are the imports are stuff that we do produce, corn, wheat, meat, so forth, and everything. And you look at over the last 20, 25 years, and you will see the importing, you will see the imports in supplementary products on a pretty straight line, whereas the complementary imports are a slow ascension up, like you're going up a mountain. So, in other words, we're importing cheaper food than we're producing. We're looking around, as I said before, we're looking around the world to find the cheapest raw materials we can, and then shipping those things out and processing them, and then turning around and reselling them to the rest of the world at a price that they can't afford.
And that's really what was going on in that whole battle down in Chiapas with the Zapatistas, was that they were being forced to stop growing corn and start growing, I forget what, tobacco or some non-edible crop to sell. And they were saying, hey, man, we just want to grow our corn and eat it, you know? We don't want to take part in this.
That's right. Well, that's what the whole third world is actually saying, you know, that we want to have enough. Let us grow our own food, and then what we don't have, what we have in surplus, then we'll export. But let us become self-sustainable. I mean, the problem in the world today is not that there's enough food for people. I mean, there are something like 4.5 pounds of food right now for every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth every day. That's a lot of food when you think about it, you know. But the problem, is getting that food from the field to the table. And we have more or less tied up. If you look at the whole food system, it would look like an hourglass. Up at the top, you have all these farmers and producing and everything, and at the bottom, you have all these consumers consuming it. And yet, that food all comes down to that very narrow funnel there between the top and the bottom, and that funnel is basically what we would call corporate agribusiness, the concentration among on the various corporations that deal in agricultural products.
Well, what can be done to shut them down?
Well, one of the things that certainly can be done is we can enforce our antitrust laws in terms of concentration, you know. But these corporations, you know, they go around and wait for, used to be in the old days, you know, the corporations would spend some money on research and development and improve the product. Now they just sit around because they've got so much cash in their coffers. They sit around and wait for a company to become successful, and then they come in and buy it up. And the Justice Department just sits back and rubber stamps these things and lets them go through. And consequently, we have more and more concentration going on. If we enforce some of these laws, these antitrust laws that we have on the books, people forget that the antitrust laws that were born in the late 19th century, that they their original purpose was to break the concentration among the big corporations like Standard Oil and Carnegie and everything. But their original intention, by the John Sherman, the senator that introduced them, was he was concerned about the concentration in agriculture. That's why he introduced them in the meat industry and everything, and all his quite concerned about that, and that was the original intent of the law. We've totally lost that intent now because we've had such a lax Justice Department, and I don't care whether that's under the Republicans or the Democrats, you know.
Well, and the thing is about executive regulation is that the people who already have the power and the money, it's easy for them to write the regulations. Whereas the farmer doesn't have a prayer writing the regulations his way, Archer Daniels Midland sits in the committee and helps write the antitrust law, you know?
Well, part of it's that, but the other part of it is also, you know, one of the problems that the farm community has in this country is in every other country in the world, farmers recognize who their enemy is. The large corporations and the conservative commodity oriented organizations and committees and so forth, and they recognize who their enemy is. In this country, unfortunately, farmers tend to constantly want to associate themselves with the very corporations that are doing them in, you know. And so it's going to take, I don't know what it's going to take, quite frankly, to get farmers off that kick and realize that the people that they keep voting in all the time into office are the very people that are doing them in, you know. And while they don't have enough political strength in terms of money, and I mean, if you believe in political power is measured by money and people, they certainly don't have the money, but they still have the people if they get them organized. And that's the problem. Get the farmers effectively organized where they can put some pressure on their congressmen and on their senators to get some of these laws enforced and everything. But you look at a political map, for example, of how the so-called red and blue map, you know, of red being Republicans and the blue being the Democrats, and you look at that for the last election, and you'll see up in the Northeast it's a mixture of red and blue, and the South it's a same mixture but more red than blue, and you get to the Mississippi River. And then from the Mississippi River to the Pacific coast, with the exception of a strip that runs from basically Vancouver, British Columbia, down to central California, with tiny blue strip there, the rest is solid red, you know. So,
and what you're saying is all these farmers are voting Republican.
That's right. That's right. You know, or they're voting the the conservative agenda, whether that be because now with the problem of not really being able to tell one party from another, they're voting that neoconservative line, and that, as I say, that's the very thing that's just doing them in. Plus, they've got an organization that keeps telling Congress and everybody that they're the voice of American agriculture, and I'm referring to the Farm Bureau and everything. Whereas the Farm Bureau is probably one of the most politically reactionary groups, political forces in this country. And I'm not speaking so much of the grassroots membership of the Farm Bureau, because in a lot of cases, if you don't belong to the Farm Bureau in your community, well, you're socially ostracized. I'm talking about the leadership, the state and the national leadership of the Farm Bureau are terribly reactionary and conservative, and have been so since their very birth, have been that way, because they want nothing to challenge their power. I mean, as I said before, there's 1.9 million farmers in this country by the latest census. The Farm Bureau boasts that it has over 5 million members. Well, who are those members? They're insurance holders. They're people that have bought Farm Bureau insurance. And when you buy Farm Bureau insurance, you buy a membership in that. And so then they turn around and they go to Congress and they say, we're the voice of American agriculture, when they're no more the voice of American agriculture than you and I.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. Sign up. You get an insurance policy. You sign up for the lobby list. There's more members of the group than there is farmers. Wow, this is great. This sounds just like some nightmare that couldn't possibly be true, but...
Well, it really is, and unfortunately, it's a nightmare that the general public does not understand, because as long as they've got food on their table, they really don't care where the food comes from, you know.
And I think this is a good point for me to ask you about that food and the 100,000 or so that are left. That are going to be left, like you said earlier. They're all planting crops with Monsanto patented genetically engineered seeds, and they sell us cows dosed full of hormones and God knows what.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you've got that kind of control over the food thing, well, you can pretty much dictate what the character of that food's going to be, you know. But the problem still, I mean, you could eliminate the problems with genetic engineering and so forth overnight, and agriculture would still be faced with its basic fundamental problem, and that is to get a fair price for what farmers produce. That's the key right there, to get a fair price for what they produce. And once you do that, then the other problems that fall into place of how to manage them and how to solve them. But until you do that, you're not going to. And, of course, the corporations are not going to allow that willingly, you know, because that cuts down on their profit margins. I mean, when you look at the food processing companies, and they are getting a return on their investment every year of anywhere from 10% to 20%, you know, whereas the farmer's return on investment over the last 10, 15 years has averaged a little over 2%.
Well, that's clearly an atrocity, but I wonder, in the better way of doing things, who determines what's a fair price, and how are they to determine what that fair price is? I mean, I understand what you're saying about the distributors have a hold on the congressmen and therefore have their centralized middle of the hourglass control. But I wonder, if it wasn't that, how would you have a fair price be set?
Well, you've got to have a farm policy that is a farmer oriented policy and not a farm oriented policy. If you understand. Follow me. In other words, that ensures that the farmer gets a fair price for what they produce. And one of the ways you do that, and it's been done before and quite successfully, but was eventually sabotaged by some of the same forces that I've previously mentioned, was that you set a minimum price for government loans to help farmers out. And when you set a floor price, that means that a floor price based on a reasonable and a fair cost of production scale. You set a minimum loan rate. That means that the corporations that buy this stuff cannot go below that loan rate, because if they do, then the farmer simply takes out a loan on it and the government stores it and keeps it for an emergency reserve or whatever, or food aid or whatever. But I mean, that's just the first step. There's a lot of other steps that I'm afraid too extensive and too too complicated to go into here on this short of a summary. But the idea is to set up some mechanism whereby you can guarantee a floor price for what they produce, and then that will more or less dictate to the market what they can pay. That's one way you can do it. The second way is you can really, as I said earlier, start putting pressure on our elected representatives in terms of enforcing the antitrust laws and breaking up some of this concentration that's becoming the totally dominate agriculture. When you have situations like three companies controlling 81% of the meat production in this country, it becomes ludicrous to say that there's a free market out there.
Oh, well, it would surely be ludicrous to say that, but I think my next question is, well, what about that for a solution, a free market? What if we just kicked the national government completely out of all farm policy so that they couldn't subsidize farmers, but they couldn't subsidize the big distributors either, and agribusiness had to figure out a way to do their things with people, their business with people consensually, or not do it?
Well, you can't. I mean, I don't think you can kick the government completely out of agriculture, because then you're really throwing the chicken to the wolves if you do that. You know, you've got to have some regulation in there. You know, but you've got to have a regulation in there that is fair and that. And then it's not dictated by a power elite, you know, and that's what the type of agriculture policy we have now, you know.
So if we kick government out of agriculture, you think that would make it easier, not harder, for the big agribusiness companies to do what they want?
Well, I think it would make it easier for them to do, because, I mean, what few regulations you've got in there now certainly is a somewhat of a protection against farmers just being treated like open slaves, you know.
Right. Well, but you did describe how they used the government in order to convince people to take out massive loans and expand where they didn't need to, and convince them to go deeper into debt and use the subsidies not for the farmer, take away the price supports for the farmers, transfer all the subsidies to the big corporations. I wonder if Archer Daniels Midland could even exist in the way it exists, which I'm only picking on them just because I don't know the names of all agribusiness firms, to tell you the truth. But would ABM be able to exist in the way it exists if the federal government hadn't been there holding their hand the whole way along?
Oh, obviously not. No, they wouldn't. You know, but to take government out of agriculture would be no solution to that. I mean, but because what little regulations that we do have. I mean, as I said before, we had a farm program that existed for 10, 15 years back and during World War II and right after World War II that was quite successful in accomplishing just the very things that I've said need to be done. But it was sabotaged by the combination of the Farm Bureau and the corporations, because we allowed the power brokers within corporate agribusiness to dictate the policy. That's the thing. I mean, back in the 70s, when the planning fence row to fence row business, that was the brainchild of Earl Butz, who was the Secretary of Agriculture. Well, if you looked at Butz's background and saw what corporations he sat on as a member of the board before he became Agriculture Secretary, and what boards he went on after he left, well, then it would become obvious what happened. Our whole trade policy, you know, was basically engineered and set by two Cargill executives, you know, back in the 70s and more recently in the 90s. Men that were both served on the Cargill board and on the Cargill executive roles in Cargill's administration. And then when they left USDA as our trade representatives, one of them went back to Cargill's executive offices, and the other one worked in a group that had a very close ties to Cargill.
It's funny how that works in every industry, isn't it?
Huh?
It works like that in every industry, too, the revolving door.
Well, it does. In a sense, it does. But it's just, it's something that people need to be aware of, and we need to get some, we need to get some more joint actions between farm groups, rural groups, and consumer groups, and labor groups, working to influence to money that they might have tied up in pension funds and things like that that invest in these companies to get a better representation on these boards and make them more socially responsible.
That's definitely one way to do it. Is to buy up the stock and try to control that board of directors.
That's right. I mean, when after ABM had the great price fixing scandal back in 96, there was a lot of criticism of the board because they had so many of these executives from other corporations and sitting on their board, and the teachers' pension fund out in California. Because they had a fairly large investment in ABM stock, they introduced some stockholder resolutions which required ABM to hire more outside directors rather than just simple sons of Dwayne Andrus, the president CEO of the company. So it can be done, you know, but it takes organization, and that's the key, you know, in practically everything we're facing now is organize, you know.
Which was my next question. Can you please describe it? When in your introduction, I must have read 15 things that you're a part of, for organizations and unions mm-hmm. and boards of directors of things. Maybe you can tell us about some of these organizations and what they do and where we can learn about them and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you'll pardon me for my immodesty, but one of the things that you people might want to do is if they would like to keep up on what's going on that you don't see in the media about these corporations, why they can always get a copy of my newsletter online, the Agribusiness Examiner, by simply sending an email to avkrebs, that's all one word, at earthlink.net, and it's all lowercase. And I'll just put them on the list, and then they can get the newsletter.
That was A-V as in Victor, Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, right?
Right.
At what?
Earthlink.net.
Okay.
They'll also see though, when they get it, there's at the end, there's a editor's note, and it'll tell you about a website, too, that I have that they can look at, too. Get some background on these different things we've talked about, and also some links to organizations and other sources of information on corporate agribusiness. As far as groups go, there's a number of groups around the country that are working on these things. The small groups, and they tend to be fairly local groups, but they're in some cases have been quite effective in some of the issues that they've taken on. The one group, the National Family Farm Coalition, is made up of I think something like 38 different local groups, you know, and it's headquartered in Washington, D.C., its president is George Naylor, an Iowa corn and soybean farmer, and its executive officer is Kathy Ozer, and she does a marvelous job of keeping track of what farm legislation is being talked about and where it's going and who are the players and so forth and everything, and they've been in existence now for about 15-20 years. There's a National Farmers Union, which is not anywhere near the size of the Farm Bureau, but it's a very effective grassroots organization. Has various state organizations. One in Texas is one. Wes Sims, the president, is very progressive farm leader. And John Hansen, the president of the Nebraska Farmers Union, is another very good leader in the movement. There is the Missouri Rural Crisis Center that has done a lot of work with hog producers and trying to keep corporate hog factories out of these communities with their environmental runoffs and polluted runoffs and so forth. There's a Rural Advancement Fund International, which works with the Southern farmers and small family farmers, and they've been good in terms of also bringing attention to the plight of the contract poultry growers that are just, you know, being decimated by folks like Tyson's and ConAgra. There's rural Vermont that's been working with the dairy farmers up there. There's the Family Farm Defenders in Wisconsin that have been very active in the dairy problems that we have there, and also in terms of the working with exchanges, so to speak, of farmers from other countries, bringing them to the U.S. and they visiting other countries and talking with their farmers and sharing their common concerns. So there's a lot of different groups around that are doing these things, you know. But again, when it comes to a real political force in Washington, why there's we have problems because, you know, we're spread out. We don't have the capital that these other groups, the commodity groups and the Farm Bureau have, and in terms of being able to influence the being able to influence legislation to the extent that these others do.
All right, tell me your website one more time. I want to make sure that people know. I'll have a link on the internet, but for people listening,
Comes out regularly. I try to get it out twice a week, and it's called the Agribusiness Examiner. It's an online newsletter which attempts to monitor corporate agribusiness from a public interest perspective, and they can get it by simply sending me their name and their email address to azkrebs@earthlink.net.
Hey, I've really enjoyed this. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today. Albert Krebs directs the Corporate Agribusiness Research Project and is the author of the book, The Corporate Reapers, The Book of Agribusiness. Also, make sure and look on the internet for the AgBiz Teller Online and the Agribusiness Examiner. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today, sir.
Okay, Tom. Thank you.